You sent me a list of questions that were remaining, right, from yesterday. I want to read a few of them, and I think it's faster if I just read them rather than you going through them. So I'm going to try to answer these questions, which I think are very thoughtful. Maybe a lot of them actually may have been answered in our conversation already. The first one is, what's the difference between a negative projection onto someone and naming what is clearly evident in the behavior of someone who is abusing other people? I think this is a very good question and a very difficult one. And it's a question, of course, that is extremely relevant in many people's lives. I think anyone who's in a family, if you're a parent, you have to discipline your children, and you have to use your wisdom to be able to guide as a moral leader with the sufficient legitimacy that they will pay attention to you and learn from you. That's almost gone, by the way, on a parental level, and the social order has even taken it away from the parents, that they no longer are granted that legitimacy by the big other, because the big other wants to destroy family systems and even couples and all relationships of love and trust. The key point is that if there is something that is happening that is abusive, one has to approach it without an emotional charge. And one has to approach it with an open mind, that if it's a possibility, if the conditions allow it, to have a conversation with that person, to understand their perspective of where they're coming from as to why they're doing this and what's going on, and to try to deal with this in a way of mediation and of probing to understand with compassion in order to change what's happening, but without accusation or attack or that kind of thing. There are other situations where one may have to act in a moment, and one will have to trust one's heart about that. But if it's in a situation, let's say in a community, where someone is, let's say, violating Dharma in a way that's disturbing the field for everyone, there should be a consensus that is going on. And an assessment by everyone involved who are in agreement, so that it's not something arbitrary and there is a clear accuracy that the field supports. And then, again, things should always be done as a therapeutic and an educational process of asking someone to who has, let's say, an admitted habit of acting out in ways that are abusive or otherwise inappropriate, to probe in their own inner work to get to the root of it. And so things have to be treated in as compassionate and patient and tolerant and accommodating a way in order to give time and space for transformation to happen internally. But it has to. One has a responsibility, nonetheless, to support the Dharma of the field, so as not to create other kinds of problems that would be created if this one wasn't dealt with. It would become a precedent that would be imitated by others, etc. That kind of thing. So one has to use one's wisdom and one's experience to deal with this in a way that is as non-egoic as possible, and also to see the subconscious aspects of this, that there is whenever there is some kind of acting out, there's an internal resistance to being in the situation. One is calling for attention, One is calling for change. One may even be calling to leave and to make an exit from a situation that one cannot be resonant with because of internal constructs or drives that are in opposition to what's happening in the field. So there are great subtleties that have to be understood before one can deal with this, and it has to be dealt with as much as possible through receiving a sense of the ritta, the divine order, and the fulfilling of the needs of the field, rather than coming from any kind of a projection. And one becomes aware of the difference between those two, because one has an emotional charge and the other doesn't. So that's one thing. Another that occurs to me is that the social order will put people into these kinds of positions that will create tremendous karmic difficulties. For example, people want to be promoted in the social order to higher levels of management, for example, when they're not ready to be able to make these decisions in a non-egoic way. And not only will things get out of order very quickly because people will smell the illegitimacy and the inaccuracy and all of that, but one will become overwhelmed with the responsibility and the burden of the kinds of decisions one has to make. You know, imagine Putin having to make decisions that are going to kill, that are killing, massacring, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, Ukrainians, Russians, others, and having that kind of a karmic burden that comes with that. I had a friend long ago, a high school, very close friend, who became a lawyer and then it was worked in the district attorney's office as a prosecuting attorney, which I wouldn't have done personally, but then got promoted, actually elected to being a judge in the criminal court. And we kept in contact over many years as I was, you know, observing the progress of her career. But I recall very distinctly the first case that she wrote me about, where she had to sentence someone to death. This was such a burden in her own soul that she ended up dying young and could not handle it. And I don't know whether she was aware of that, but to me it felt very much like that committing oneself to making those kinds of judgments in a situation where one is not really at the pay grade to be able, psychologically and spiritually, to be responsible for that is something that literally can be lethal. The light can go out. So it's important not to strive to have power before one is ready. In fact, one shouldn't strive for it at all. It appears as a result of the fields bringing it into being, and it doesn't come at all from any internal drive for power. But this is the kind of situation that many egos who are within the social order, who have become accomplices to mass murder. Anyone who's a pharmacist or a doctor or a nurse, right, who knew but couldn't talk because they'd lose their job or they would suffer in some way because of speaking out, and who became accomplices. Can you understand the burden that such beings are carrying? That will have consequences in their soul and in their lives. So these are the kinds of questions that are far deeper than simply calling out somebody for for doing something wrong, but it is a universal question that can only be resolved by attaining the level of authority that comes from pure spirit. Anyway, a long answer, but I hope that was useful. Second one, to help discern between legitimate spiritual experience and possible lower mind delusion, what can we expect the experience to be like when the awareness moves to the soul in earnest with an open eye of wisdom? I think I answered that with your question, but it is an important question, because there are delusions that happen, but a delusion can only happen to an ego, okay? So if you are egoless, you cannot have a delusion by definition. The delusion is something that happens in duality. It's a subject-object relation, you know? I was visited by, an angel or an avatar or whatever. One can have a fantasy of that, or demonic beings or whatever. They will only be able to arise in an ego mind that is split, and it's the split consciousness that allows the delusion to occur. Once that split has been healed, then those sorts of things don't happen. The whole imaginary register of consciousness is transcended. Okay. The third question is, someone is saying, okay, it's nice to talk about being in transcendence and having popcorn and enjoying the show, but what if your body is in a state of starvation or has been dragged off to the gulag to suffer a long, painful death, et cetera, et cetera? So, yes, I agree. These things are... do happen, actually, and they have been happening. So the only thing one can do is to be spiritually detached from the body identity and dispassionate about its fate. There is no other way to deal with it than that. And everyone knows your body is mortal. You are going to die as a bodily being. And it could be a violent death, it could be a sudden death that you see a lot of people, they even now call it sudden adult death syndrome, because it's happening so often to people. Now in that last moment when somebody suddenly realizes they're dying, and then a minute later or less, their body has lost consciousness and they're actually dead, but in that short time, tremendous information comes. It all is revealed. Like near-death experiencers say, you get a life review in that moment that you're clinically dead. Well, when these kinds of things happen, suddenly you know, and there may not even be time for remorse or anything else until you enter into a bardo state after having left the body. But there will be a moment of clarity as the soul realizes time is up, and this life is over. So those things will happen, and the more that one has gone through death prior to the death of the body, gone through the death of the ego, and has understood all of those shadow elements that don't have to suddenly pop up in a bardo field as wrathful deities and that kind of thing, the more that one can go directly to the great light and not be detoured into some intermediary realm to deal with your shadow. So you don't want to have any shadow left. And the sooner that is dealt with, the better. But by the way, it takes a long time to starve. You know, people go on water fasts for 3 or 4 months before they even begin to lose muscle fiber, let alone reach starvation. Even thin people, right? It's not, you can live for a long time, especially if you are doing it deliberately and consciously. You're fasting, you're not starving, and the body's resources can be preserved for a long time because the metabolism slows down, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, somebody will say, I skipped lunch and I'm starving, but they're not, right? Many people will say that and actually think that they are starving, but it's a fantasy, it's a delusion. And soon, with a food shortage, you may have to skip lunch more than once and realize you're not starving, so that there isn't a panic that has nothing to do with your physical well-being, but is simply a psychological terror of lack that is being projected into the food system. So it's very important that we unplug all of those triggers that could create a panic situation, because there will be a general panic when the grocery stores start shutting down and there is no food to be had in your neighborhood or in the town, right? There will be panic. You know, there was panic over the lack of toilet paper. Imagine when there's no food to eat, right? So we will be having to deal with that and seeing a general panic going on. Okay, enough of that. Moving on. Okay, this question is, daily life requires constant choices in words and actions. That's the tricky part. Can you speak to that? Are you saying that there is no objective reality whatsoever? No, I'm not saying that at all. There is an objective reality. But what is being said is that the object is not really separate from the subject. In the same way that if you are dreaming and you're a character in the dream, that dream, from your perspective, is an objective world. And so to whatever extent you're living in subject-object duality, yes, you're in an objective world. But it can be objective without being real, okay? Something can be objectively true within the frame of reference of the phenomenal plane and still not be real. And that discernment and distinction has to be made. Okay. Okay, considering the coming collapse of economy, social orders, and any future that can be planned, are we all destined to die, to transition to a magical immortal state, or can we become divine avatars while alive in this current vessel without having to perish? Well, okay. A divine avatar is one who realizes they do not perish, that you are imperishable. But a divine avatar is not identified with the body. The avatar is the spirit, not the body. You know, the movie Avatar switched it, and now everybody thinks that the icon is the avatar, that it's the body that is the avatar. No, it's the spirit that animates the body, that doesn't care if the body perishes or not. That's what being an avatar means, that you can have one body and trade it for another or not have any or occupy many, many bodies. It doesn't matter. But you are in a state of consciousness that is non-duality, that isn't even perceiving separate bodies. So but bodies in the phenomenal plane have to perish because they are constructs. They arise temporarily. Your body was not beginningless. If your body was beginningless, it will also be endless, okay? But for most of you, your body was actually born at some point in time and space. If there's anybody who was not born, who just magically appeared as an adult, then that's different, okay? And we'll talk about that case if it arises. Not that common. But No, we have to be okay about death and rebirth and not disturbed by it. Okay. Is it true that alone meditation doesn't affect the morphogenetic field as much as group meditation? No, that's not the case. What affects the morphogenic field is the coherence of the signal that you're giving off. So if there's a whole group meditating, but half of them are asleep, you know, they're not going to achieve much in the morphic field. Or if they're all, you know, having, you know, reverie states in chakra 2 and chakra 3, you know, no. So everything will depend on the vibrational frequency and the coherence of the signal. Whether it's coming through one vehicle or through many is not that relevant. What's relevant is the strength of the signal. And one sage can be equal to a group of 1,000, you know, meditating. So it's not about numbers. Okay. Healing, is it harder to let go of constructs in familiar environments? Origin, country of origin, family, friends. No, except that if you are in a situation with others who are projecting on you to be a certain way and you feel obliged to be who they think you are, then of course you're going to limit your revelation that that's not who you are at all. And so it will become a barrier to going beyond a certain level of your being. But other than that, you can leave your familiar surroundings and go to a cave in India and take your internal family system with you and be just as conflicted in that cave as you are in New York City or wherever you might have gone from. Okay. What was the purpose of the real self creating or dreaming the duality? Thank you. Well, again, the bubble is the only place where the non-self can hang out, right? And it's only the non-self that can know the self. There has to be duality for the self to be realized. And then the popping of that duality back into the non-duality, that redemption of the self that had alienated itself from itself become the opposite of itself, apparently, but opposites being the same, ultimately it must return to that unity of being. So it is that duality and the creation of differences that produce an appreciation of the infinite complexity, the infinite facets of the diamond mind of God, that otherwise no being could ever know, because there wouldn't be beings to know all of those infinite perspectives and potentialities. And let's face it, God got bored, you know, not having a creation, and created the most fascinating cosmic drama that's imaginable. So why did Shakespeare write plays? Why did Beethoven write symphonies? You know, why does creativity happen? It's part of the nature of spirit to create. And so, of course, God is going to create worlds. Okay. Once you are in non-duality, will you still see others perceiving good and evil, but you will act from a different point of view that transcends karma. Is that right? Yes, that is right. You will be aware that others are in duality, but you will be aware of its illusory nature. And here's someone saying, I struggle to understand what you brought up about protection. In my experience of unity with all life, there is no need for protection. Being in the moment in our true nature include love, peace, and harmony. There is zero fear and a welcoming of all experience, all moments. Why would one need protection in that space? Well, that is true. I totally agree with that. It's not that you have a need for protection. It is that grace comes to one who is in that state, not for their own sake, and not because there is fear, but because the power of grace changes the morphic field in that surrounding and produces a different outcome that is that creates more goodness in the world as a result of what looks like protection that is actually simply the unfoldment of the absolute perfection of reality that is always the case. So I, for example, have an anecdote. I had a teacher in India, and I told some people this story years ago, but it's a true story. He had several women disciples who were married, and they became brahmacharis as a result of studying with him, and their husbands became furious that their wives would no longer have sexual relations with them, and they were furious at this teacher for being the cause of their suddenly lacking their pleasure. And they got together and hired a hitman to kill him. And they hired a Sikh ex-soldier who was a very tough character who came in with a sword or a machete or something in the middle of the night. And when he got into the room, he saw the teacher sitting, meditating in samadhi, and he was going to run him through with the sword. But suddenly he saw that his body was filled with light and that it was emanating a force field that paralyzed him. And then suddenly he was just totally filled with remorse. He began to cry. He realized that he was in the presence of God, and he threw the sword down. He bowed down to him, and he became his disciple. Okay? Now, the teacher didn't need that. It didn't happen out of fear, but it produced extraordinary results in the community, particularly among the husbands who had hired him and others who shifted their attitudes as a result. And the guy became the night watchman at the ashram. And so I talked to him and I heard the story from him. And he was protecting everybody in the ashram. Nobody minded. Most people didn't even know he was there because they were asleep before he went on duty, you know, because you have to get up like at 3 a.m., you know, at the latest there. So you weren't a night owl. But he did walk around with a rifle, actually. Mostly he chased away monkeys, I think. But, you know, he symbolically was protecting the ashram. But not because anybody was afraid. You know, it wasn't about that. But the whole transformation of his life into becoming a yogi and serving in the only way he could serve in that capacity, becoming a true devotee, had an extraordinary shift on the whole community. So anyway, that's just one story of why those things happen. It has nothing to do with fear. Okay. Is trauma healing an act of the ego? No, healing can never be an act of the ego, but it can happen through acts of the ego. So a therapist or a Reiki practitioner or someone who is still in the ego can do work that has effects of healing, but it wasn't their ego that produced the effect. It may even have happened in spite of their ego, but out of their prayer or their good wishes and their intention of producing good karma may have had an effect in bringing grace to bear on the situation. Can trying to fight the ego actually feed it? Yes, it does. Because who is fighting the ego? It has to be another part of the ego, right? So that's not how you get rid of the ego. You have to actually love it to death. But through disidentifying from it and recognizing it as an artifact that needs to be taken out of its misery. Okay. Another one is about time as a circle, and yes, a circle is endless. Time is cyclical, but the cycle of time exists within eternity. So from the perspective of God, there is no time. All time is present. and eternity is present in every moment of time if you're in that state of awareness. So really, there is no time, and that's the illusion that is ultimately transcended. Okay, and then there is someone who is criticizing me for bringing up this question of power. He mentioned how many great yogis are leaving the world, leaving their power up for grabs. It's not exactly that. It's not just the absence of great yogis, but the loss of faith of the general population that is producing a despair and hopelessness and a disconnect from God. And those who believe are angry at God, even, rather than making a connection with love. So therefore, there are fewer instruments who can download that that divine power. But it's not power that can be used by the ego. It's the power to surrender the ego. That's what is now available, the power to become egoless. And I know that everyone knows about siddhis. You know, they're in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And if you've read the Mahasiddha literature, you know, it talks about the powers that are gained by or can be gained by people in higher states of consciousness. But there is a fail-safe protection that the kind of powers that can be abused will not be given unless there is an egoless situation and a condition. And so the powers are, it's not a problem. But yes, there are people who may start out practicing yoga or other forms of spiritual processing in order to get powers, but they will soon realize that they are a dead end, and they will produce negative karmic feedback or backlash, and you can't get to liberation as long as that desire is there. After one is desireless, these things emerge. And they often emerge without the knowledge of the embodied level of the individual about them. Like Ramana would often be told that miracles happened around him and people would come and thank him. Somebody would pray to him and then they'd be healed or something miraculous would happen. And Ramana said, really? He didn't know anything about this and didn't care. But, oh, that's interesting, you know. But there was no interest, obviously no taking credit or no interest in the consequences of any of this, because the perfection of all that is a given. But these things happen without necessarily your even knowing that they are going to happen, no matter what level of consciousness you're in, because there's no interest in the phenomenal plane activities any longer. And you know, Padre Pio was very famous for this. And he miracles were happening. He had the stigmatism, you know, the wounds of Christ. He was bleeding, and he became famous, and people would visit him, by talking to him or praying with him or doing a confession with him, extraordinary miracles would happen, and the papal establishment got afraid that he was getting too popular, and they shut him down and locked him into his cell for a long time. But people began to report that they saw him in Rome or they saw him in other places. He was bilocating and interacting with people all over the place. He wasn't stuck in his monastery after all, right? But he claimed he didn't know anything about this. I think he actually knew more than he let on, but nonetheless, these kinds of things would happen because he was in an egoless state. There's one report by an Italian pilot who in World War II said that they saw him 20,000 feet in the air telling the plane to turn right or left or whatever it was really quickly because there was flak that was being shot at it. And the pilots literally saw him standing and directing him to turn, and he did. And they saw the bullets from the flak coming up and just missing the plane. So, he was active in many ways, but all of this was happening at the level of the universal consciousness using his form, not at any kind of a personal egoic level. So hopefully that answers that question. And then the last question was about the Anasazi. Do I know anything about what happened to them? This tribe in the southeast that disappeared. The only thing I know is this. I once had a client who was a scholar of the Anasazi, and she was obsessed with them and would go there and visit the ruins and lead retreats and studied everything there was to study about them. And she came to me to do a past life regression to see if she was ever there. And so I did a series of regressions with her. She had several lives, apparently, in that culture. And you can take it with a grain of salt whether it was fantasy or whether this was true historically. But the tribe came to a point where there was almost a shift of dynasty. The old tribal chiefs died, and the next generation wanted to do things differently. They couldn't heal the conflict, and they split up. Some became what later were known as the Hopis. Some became Zunis, some other tribes. But most of them traveled to different areas and set up shop there. But they retained a lot of the the shamanic knowledge of the earlier culture, and it only gradually died out, but it still exists among some of the Hopi shamans. That's all I can tell you. I hope that's useful.